Content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is the Week Magazine. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the April 10th, 2026 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week shows five military drones flying in formation against a blue sky with clouds mixed in. Each one of the drones has the Iranian flag painted on the underside of one of the wings. The headline is Iran's Advantage, Controlling the Strait of Hormuz with Drones and Mines. And that is our first story. We'll start right there. Trump looks for the exits in Iran. With 6,000 U.S. troops on standby for a land invasion, President Trump this week changed course yet again and indicated he'd seek an exit from the war with Iran without attempting to reopen the Strait of Hormuz to oil and gas shipping. Trump said the U.S. will be leaving very soon and would have nothing to do with reopening the waterway through which 20% of the world oil supplies usually pass. Earlier in the week, Trump threatened obliteration of Iran's civilian power plants, desalination plants, and oil wells, a potential war crime, unless the strait were reopened. The Pentagon has sent Marines and combat troops to the region for a possible attempt to reopen the strait by seizing control of its shores and or by occupying Karg Island, the hub for Iran's oil exports. But with gas prices soaring over $4 a gallon for the first time since 2022 and equity markets seesawing, Trump backed away from the steep political cost of possible U.S. casualties and of extending the war by months. He indicated he was ready to walk away and let NATO allies go and open it themselves. The hard part is done. Get your own oil, Trump said. As the week went to press, Trump was scheduled to address the nation to explain why he believed the war had been won. Over the past week, Trump provided varying objectives for the war. He said his one goal was to end Iran's nuclear capacity, and that has been attained, although a stockpile of 970 pounds of near-bomb-grade uranium remains in the country, presumably inside its bombed nuclear sites. Trump also said the bombing campaign had led to regime change, although the hard-line theocratic Islamic Republic remains in control. Trump claimed that Iran's new regime president had asked for a ceasefire, but Iran, which has not changed presidents, is engaged in no negotiation, said Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi. He put Iran's trust level with the U.S. at zero. Trump said the strait would automatically open once the U.S. pulled back. Ebrahim Azizi, head of the Iranian parliament's National Security Commission, disputed that, indicating the country would now choose who could pass and charge tolls. The strait will certainly reopen, Azizi said, but not for you. What the columnist said: Trump's triumphalism is hard to reconcile with the facts on the ground, said Zachary Basu in Axios. By conventional military measures, the U.S. and Israel are dominating, but a hostile hardline regime is still in place. Iran's nuclear threat remains, and its continuing stranglehold over the Strait of Hormuz is threatening to metastasize into a long-term strategic crisis. Trump's approval rating has sunk below 40%. And 6 in 10 Americans disapprove of his handling of the war. Trump can't leave the strait in Iran's grip, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. The U.S. may be a net exporter of gas and oil, but a de facto Iran veto over Gulf shipping could cause higher global oil prices for years. And just think what it would say about the credibility of U.S. deterrence. Opening the strait by force is simply not an option, said Yoav Gallant in the Free Press. The narrow waterway can be easily mined and has nearly 100 miles of shoreline, where ships are within range of missiles, drones, and fast attack craft. Iran's drones and missiles have put the U.S. on its back foot, said Nicholas Kulish in the New York Times. Iran's continuing attacks on Israel and Gulf countries attest that it has thousands of remaining missiles and drones, which can destabilize the region and inflict a punishing cost on its foes. The president's tragic miscalculations on Iran reveal a blind spot, said Janan Ganesh in the Financial Times. Certain that everyone is driven by selfish material concerns, he doesn't grasp that human behavior can have a moral or ideological root. It is hard to conceive of a president less suited to taking on a revolutionary state with the ideological conviction to sustain a protracted fight against a hated enemy. Trump has provided the worst wartime political leadership in U.S. history, said Elliot A. Cohen in The Atlantic. The president failed to line up allies or court national unity in a time of war. The preening, bellicose defense secretary, Pete Hegseth, has cast the conflict as a holy war between Christians and Muslims. Trump's other advisors are no better, an array of toadies and lickspittles operating beyond their competence in an atmosphere of organizational chaos. Watching the cornered Trump flail, flip-flop, and bluster is embarrassing, said Thomas L. Friedman in the New York Times. This is what you get when you put into the Oval Office an impulsive, unstable man. If he weren't our president and Iran weren't a dangerous enemy, we could savor the spectacle of Trump getting what he deserves. But the cost will be steep, and we're all going to pay. We'll read the second main story today as well. Supreme Court weighs birthright citizenship. What happened? In a remarkable break with centuries of tradition, President Trump personally attended Supreme Court arguments this week, listening in as his administration asked the justices to overturn birthright citizenship. During the questioning in Trump versus Barbara, Chief Justice John Roberts and most other justices cast doubt on the constitutionality of an executive order Trump issued in his first week in office, which requires proof of paternal citizenship or permanent residency for a newborn to become a U.S. citizen. If upheld, the order could deny citizenship to some 250,000 babies a year. Solicitor General John Sauer said the new trend of birth tourism required new restrictions, but the justices pushed back. It's a new world. It's the same Constitution, Roberts said, adding, the examples you give to support strike me as very quirky. Most justices were skeptical of Sauer's arguments, but Justice Samuel Alito said an 1898 precedent, the Wong Kim Ark case, which concerned the U.S.-born son of Chinese immigrants, was not the last word on interpretations of the 14th Amendment, which grants birthright citizenship. We're dealing with something that was basically unknown at the time, said Alito, illegal immigration. The landmark hearing occurred days after the court considered arguments for a separate Trump priority, limiting mail-in balloting. In Watson versus RNC, the Republican National Committee argued that a 2020 Mississippi law allowing the counting of votes postmarked by Election Day but received up to 5 days later violates the federal law designating a single day for voting. The court's conservative majority appeared skeptical of the Mississippi law and poised to strike it down, although the three liberal justices expressed fears that such a move could invalidate all early voting and override states' constitutional powers to organize elections. Decisions on both cases are expected by July. What the columnist said. For well over a century, said Maureen Grope in USA Today, presidents, justices, and lawmakers agreed that the 14th Amendment guarantees birthright citizenship to nearly everyone. The text is clear. all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States. The exceptions arise from the jurisdiction clause, which has always been read to exclude only those children born to diplomats or to invading soldiers. But on the very first day of his second term, Trump effectively gave himself the power to redefine who is an American by issuing an executive order aimed at the children of undocumented immigrants. Every lower court that has reviewed that order has ruled against it. Still, some of the conservative Supreme Court justices seem to take the administration's arguments seriously. The outcome could hinge on what domiciled means, said Adam Liptak and Ann E. Marimo in the New York Times. In the Wong Kim Ark case, Wong's parents were legal U.S. residents domiciled in California. Sauer argued that illegal immigrants and temporary visitors are not domiciled here, and therefore their babies are not citizens, meaning the court could side with him and not overturn the precedent. Trump's presence added to the drama of an emotionally charged session, said Abby Van Sickle, also in the Times. Conservative justices asked tough questions of Cecilia Wang, a lawyer for the American Civil Liberties Union, who is herself the recipient of birthright citizenship. Her Taiwanese parents were in the U.S. on student visas when she was born. If the court were to find for the administration, the damage would ripple far beyond undocumented immigrants, said Scott Titshaw and Stephen Yale Lohr in The Hill. Junking birthright citizenship would leave millions of children without legal status, many of them Latino or Asian heritage. And because the executive order defines parents as immediate biological progenitors, it could deny citizenship to children of same-sex couples and those relying on surrogates. The stakes could not be higher. Yet Trump's relationship with the Supreme Court has never been more toxic, said James Remoser in the Wall Street Journal. Since the court ruled against his tariffs in February, he has repeatedly disparaged the patriotism and loyalty of the justices who ruled against him. Though birthright citizenship may be a closer case than expected, the administration appears on shaky ground. Trump seemed to realize that in the courtroom. After he left, he posted inaccurately on Truth Social, "We are the only country in the world stupid enough to allow birthright citizenship." Our controversy of the week, social media. Will jury awards protect kids from damage? Big tech may have reached an inflection point, said Dave Lee in Bloomberg. A Los Angeles jury last week ordered Meta and Google to pay a combined $6 million to a 20-year-old woman known as Kaylee GM, who claimed their apps caused her depression, body shame, and trauma throughout her childhood. ByteDance, which developed TikTok and Snap Incorporated, previously settled out of court. The decision came a day after New Mexico jury found that Meta owes $375 million for failing to protect kids from sexual predators online. Though Meta and Google will appeal the rulings, thousands of similar lawsuits are waiting in the wings. Social media giants could face billions in future judgments. That's because Kaylee's lawyers made a novel argument others will use, said Hannah Epstein in the Dispatch. They sidestepped First Amendment concerns and Section 230, which shield social media platforms from responsibility for what their users post, by focusing not on the content itself, but on the algorithms and app designs that keep minors hooked to Instagram and YouTube for hours. Citing a trove of internal documents from Google and Meta, they contended that the companies deliberately targeted preteens with intentionally addictive features such as infinite scroll, autoplay, notifications, and beauty filters. "We're basically pushers," one Instagram employee wrote to colleagues. "Parents will understandably celebrate these verdicts," said David French in the New York Times. "But the First Amendment is our most fundamental right, and it protects even toxic and harmful speech. I don't doubt that social media can be damaging, but a social media site is not a bottle of alcohol or a cigarette. Parents are not helpless, and we can and should control our kids' use of smartphones and these apps." This social media shakedown is a big victory for trial lawyers, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. But it's a slippery slope that will invite countless more lawsuits. "Are platforms supposed to prohibit users from posting photos that might make someone feel depressed or insecure? That sure covers a lot of what's online." "It's easy for critics to blame greedy plaintiffs and runaway juries," said Austin Surratt in The Guardian. "But this case presented mountains of evidence that Meta and Google engineered the addictive qualities of their sites. That's legal negligence for which countless kids like Kaylee have paid the price. For Meta and Google, it appears the moment of reckoning has arrived at long last," said Valerie Hudson in the Deseret News. "With the shield of Section 230 finally pierced, social media firms now face the threat of immense financial harm if they continue to create compulsive, unstoppable engagement with toxic garbage." "Don't bank on it," said Nicholas Creel in Newsweek. "These verdicts may not survive appeals and have not created any coherent legal standard governing how social media companies may or may not build their products. Only Congress can create those standards through legislation. But how do lawmakers define what's addictive or damaging?" said Douglas Murray in the New York Post. "The onus is us, the consumers of big tech products. You'd be hard-pressed to find an adult in the U.S. who doesn't have an unhealthy relationship with their smartphone. No wonder our children get hooked, too. The long-term solution to this problem lies in all of our hands." Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. Good week for crisis control after the childless and unmarried Senator Lindsey Graham, 70, was photographed at the Space Mountain ride at Disney World and having breakfast at Chef Mickey's while Congress was in recess. He quickly posted photos of himself shooting clay pigeons with a shotgun, adding, "Doesn't get much better than that." It's a good week for priorities after Pittsburgh said it would close its public school buildings and pivot 20,000 students to remote learning next week when the NFL draft is held in the city. As many as 700,000 football fans are expected to descend on the downtown for the three-day event. It was a good week for telling it like it is. After President Trump explained his personnel philosophy, "I hang out with losers because it makes me feel better," he said. "I hate guys that are very, very successful, and you have to listen to their success stories." But it was a bad week for innocence after British researchers found that around a quarter of babies grasp the concept of deception by the age of 10 months, and that by age 3 they become, in the researchers' words, "quite adept and cunning little liars." It's a bad week for hard candy after the Food and Drug Administration announced a nationwide recall of two chocolate products sold by a Northern California adult novelty company after they were found to contain life-threatening quantities of the active ingredients in Viagra and Cialis. Finally, it was a bad week for space babies after researchers found that low-gravity environments like that of space stations, the Moon, or Mars could reduce the number of human sperm that reach an egg by about 50%. "Sperm in microgravity still move," said the lead author, Nicole McPherson. "They just cannot find their way. On the briefing page, the Ayatollah's enforcers, Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, keeps order, runs the economy, and exports terrorism. What is the IRGC? Officially, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps is the military force sworn to protect Iran's ruling clerics. Yet its enormous reach into all aspects of political and economic life makes it a state within a state. Far better resourced than Iran's regular armed forces, the IRGC controls roughly half of the country's $376 billion economy and directs Iran's nuclear program. It has responded to international sanctions with a resistance economy of illicit activities, including smuggling arms, narcotics, and alcohol. Abroad, its network of violent proxy groups in Iraq, Lebanon, Syria, Yemen, and Gaza has destabilized the Middle East for decades, and the current war has only further tightened its stranglehold on Iranian society. When President Trump early on threatened the IRGC with certain death if it did not immediately surrender, it responded by mining the Strait of Hormuz and green-lighting attacks on Gulf Arab states. The survival of the Islamic Republic is dependent on the IRGC, said Georgetown University political scientist Nader Hashimi. They were created for a moment like this. How is the IRGC created? After the 1979 Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini didn't trust Iran's conventional army, saying it had the Shah in its blood. He set up the IRGC as his own parallel force. During the Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s, it absorbed the myriad local armed groups that had sprung up around mosques. When Ayatollah Ali Khamenei became supreme leader in 1989, he allowed the IRGC to take over the economy, controlling weapons procurement, construction, and government contracts. Now it has some 200,000 active members and holds monopolies over critical infrastructure and major industries. It's like a huge investment company with a complex of business empires and trading companies, while also being a de facto foreign ministry, said Mohsen Sazagara, who helped found the IRGC and is now an exiled Iranian dissident. I know of no other institution like the Revolutionary Guards. An attractive employer for men in need of steady income, it has an intense indoctrination program stressing the imperative of jihad against Jews and other infidels. It exports these ideals through its elite branch, the Quds Force. What is the Quds Force? That's K-U-D-S. Quds. It's the armed IRGC wing charged with spreading revolutionary values abroad and training proxy militias. In the early 1980s, a Quds group in Lebanon helped create Hezbollah and masterminded the bombings of the U.S. Embassy and the U.S. French barracks in Beirut, which together killed 370 people, 258 of them Americans. And it trained Shiite militias in Iraq to plant roadside bombs that killed hundreds of U.S. soldiers. But its primary arch enemy is Israel and Jews, who are frequently targeted by its proxies. In 1994, a bomb killed 85 people at a Jewish community center in Buenos Aires, an attack said to have been planned by the IRGC's current commander, General Ahmad Vahidi. The force trained Hamas in Gaza ahead of the October 7, 2023 massacre of Israelis, and IRGC plotted arson attacks hit Jewish institutions in Australia in 2024. Are there other wings? The Basij, a paramilitary security force, has around 600,000 reservists at its disposal to quash dissent. Black-clad brigades typically disperse protests with batons, tear gas, and guns. Their crackdown on last winter's protests killed up to 40,000 civilians. The population of Iran may wish what it will, said former U.S. Army advisor Brad Paddy, but they are meant to live in terror of the IRGC. The Revolutionary Guards also have an intelligence service, as well as their own versions of traditional military service branches. That includes ground troops, a 15,000-member air force that runs Iran's missile program, and a navy of some 20,000 that patrols the Strait of Hormuz. All these branches, plus the IRGC's drone center and cyber command, are directing Iran's response to the U.S.-Israeli attacks. How are they doing? Better than anticipated. U.S. and Israeli airstrikes have hit well over 15,000 Iranian targets, destroying ballistic missile sites as well as killing Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei. IRGC Commander Mohammed Pakpour, Security Chief Ali Larijani, and several other senior officials. But Iran, which watched the 2003 toppling of Saddam Hussein next door, has been hardening its regime ever since. The IRGC has built layers into its dispersed chains of command and trained its troops in asymmetric warfare. The Trump boasted that U.S. strikes have demolished Iran's regular navy and air force. The IRGC versions of those forces have struck more than 20 commercial vessels, sometimes swarming them with lightly armed speedboats. These strategies, Iranian Foreign Minister Sayeb Abbas Araghchi recently claimed, mean that bombings in our capital have no impact on our ability to conduct war. What might weaken IRGC's grip? Decapitation strikes won't do it. The guards have a bench of replacements handy for each senior post, and their forces are fighting to protect the system, not any individual. Still, some IRGC units are reporting shortages of food, ammunition, and basic supplies, and the decentralization of their control raises the risk that one or more might eventually defect. Defeating the IRGC would require not a swift campaign, but at best a prolonged and costly war of attrition, said Oxford political scientist Ashkan Hashimapour. But this may prove difficult for the American president to sustain politically. Time for a few of the best columns. First up, why Trump tilts at windmills. President Trump's war on wind has reached an absurd new low, said Paul Krugman. Under a deal reached last week, the administration will pay Total Energies, a French energy giant, almost $1 billion to not produce energy. That's right, U.S. taxpayers are effectively bribing Total Energies to give up its leases to develop two offshore U.S. wind farms, even as we are engulfed in a global fossil fuel crisis triggered by the Iran war. Renewable energy is now generally cheaper than oil and coal and isn't vulnerable to global price swings. But Trump has irrationally hated wind turbines ever since several were built within sight of his golf course in Scotland. Republicans, meanwhile, have succumbed to the fossil fuel industry's propaganda machine, which falsely portrays renewables as unreliable and climate change as a distant, manageable problem. Insecure men on the MAGA right embrace Trump's anti-wind crusade because they think renewable energy is woke. Apparently, real men burn stuff that manly men mine or pump from the ground. As a result, we're now ceding the future to China and other countries that are racing ahead on wind and solar. That's a price Trump and his followers are willing to pay to feel more manly and own the libs. How Ukraine is keeping Russia at bay. Russia's brutal invasion of Ukraine has been halted by the most powerful drone army in the world, said Max Boot. Ukraine's low-cost, lethal drones have had incredible success both in defending the country from Russian drone and missile assaults and in inflicting severe damage on Russia's frontline troops and oil facilities. As Russia unleashed a fear air assault last week on churches, hospitals, and homes, Ukrainian interceptor drones brought down 95% of Russia's version of the Iranian Shahed drones. Meanwhile, Kyiv has sent long-range drones packed with explosives to hit Russia's oil export terminals on the Baltic Sea, more than 600 miles away, cutting Russia's oil exports by 40%. Out of desperate necessity, Ukraine has reinvented warfare against a much more powerful nation by designing and hand-building a wide variety of drones in enormous numbers, 4 million a year and climbing. About 30,000 Russian soldiers are being killed or wounded every month, with drones causing 90% of the casualties. Putin will ruthlessly press on, but he cannot overcome Ukraine's drones or another weapon the Russians cannot match. The determination of a democratic nation to stay free. This column comes from Ghana. Forcing a global reckoning. The world can no longer look away, said Ras Mubarak. The UN General Assembly overwhelmingly approved a resolution last week recognizing the transatlantic slave trade as the gravest crime against humanity. President John Mahama of Ghana, the land where the chains first clanked, led the historic push. The resolution urges nations to apologize for the Holocaust against Africans and contribute to reparations fund for descendants of enslaved people. Mahama said the resolution was a safeguard against forgetting, particularly as in the U.S. President Trump has complained that museums focus too much on how bad slavery was. In fact, there's no overstating the magnitude of the crime. More than 12 million Africans were abducted and enslaved, fathers ripped from their children, mothers torn from their homes, children who would never know their ancestral home. On the passage to the New World, bodies were thrown overboard like refuse when the inevitable fever struck. Women were violated in the dark. The U.S. voted against the resolution, and the EU countries abstained. But the rest of the world insists that these nations finally confront the foundations of their prosperity. These people mattered. Their labor built empires. Remembering the industrialized horror of slavery and offering reparative justice is not charity. It is a debt long overdue. The last word, our in-depth article, the spies who went native. During the Cold War, some deep cover Eastern Bloc operatives decided their American lives weren't so bad, said Zach Dorfman in Politico. After the Iron Curtain fell, they wanted to stay. At 5:04 p.m. on October 17, 1989, San Francisco began to shake. The Loma Prieta earthquake caused widespread destruction. Across the region, freeways and buildings collapsed. At the city's FBI headquarters, a local counterintelligence agent was told to check on a small, nondescript, two-unit home in San Francisco's foggy Outer Sunset District. The agent drove all the way across town to a quiet block in one of the quietest corners of the city. The house was still standing. There was no damage. And because there was no damage, the tenant of the in-law unit, an ultra-deep cover Soviet bloc spy, would remain oblivious to all the secret FBI surveillance concealed inside his apartment, the bugs recording his every utterance, the video cameras covertly tracking his every move. The FBI's operation against him remained hidden, at least for now. But not for long. Revealed here for the first time, this tale of a Czech spy, based on conversations with 9 former FBI and CIA officials, would help spark a burst of intense intelligence diplomacy at a moment when the U.S. and Europe were fundamentally reevaluating their relationships. Today, the U.S.'s closest allies speak of an irrevocable rupture with Washington. This is a story about another older America, a superpower capable of restraint and victory, and even, one might say, grace for its ostensible enemies, former Soviet bloc spies embedded across the country, some of whom blended in so well they became the Americans they sought to imitate. "I remember the case, and I remember the guy," said former FBI counterintelligence agents Bill Kinane, chief of the FBI's Eastern Bloc Squad in San Francisco in the late 1980s. The deep cover operative lived out by the beach and worked as a doorman in a hotel downtown, he recalled. Like other Warsaw Pact services, Czech intelligence was ultimately subordinate to Moscow, but the Czechs were considered particularly adept antagonists. When Kinane and his San Francisco-based FBI colleagues received information that there was a deep cover Czech operative in their backyard, they had to take it seriously. The fact that they had this information at all was an intelligence coup. It had been passed to the Bureau by the CIA, which itself received information via a small European country's intelligence service. I'm sure he was given up by some defector or something, because otherwise how would we have known about it, said Kinane. Because he was living here like an illegal. In the world of espionage, illegal is a term of art. It refers to the deepest cover type of intelligence officer who has no official relationship with the government for which he or she secretly works. While many spies operate under what's known as legal or official cover, stationed as diplomats or military attachés, or even embassy support staff like cooks or custodians, so-called illegals are, at least formally, completely untethered from their country's government. In fact, they often assume entirely new identities and nationalities while undertaking their spying. Like the fictional Russian operatives in the FX series The Americans, they could spend years, often decades, integrating themselves into their target countries, having families, building careers, and cultivating wholly new lives for themselves, all while secretly working for their home country. For professional spy hunters, uncovering an illegal's network is the holy grail, because these operatives are so hard to identify. They can burrow so deeply into their target countries over such long periods, often with elaborate fake identities and backstories. So when the CIA alerted its FBI counterparts about the deep cover spy, the Bureau sprang into action, recalled 6 former FBI agents. It wiretapped the Czech's phone lines at his apartment. It installed secret cameras. It had Bureau agents surveil his every move. The deep cover Czech spy was living under an assumed identity, but until the CIA's tip to the FBI, his cover story had been plausible enough to otherwise escape scrutiny. According to his fake identity, or legend in spy speak, the man was ethnically Czech, but had been born in South America after his parents immigrated there. Later on, he escaped the Iron Curtain, probably thanks to his South American passport, made it to a refugee camp in Europe, and eventually settled in San Francisco. As far as actual spying went, though, the Czech operative didn't seem to be doing much. But that, FBI officials knew, wasn't all that unusual. Many deep cover spies spend years immersing themselves in societies they're targeting before undertaking any substantial espionage, like meeting with local agents or transmitting sensitive intelligence back to their overseers abroad. Even then, some are held in reserve in sleeper cells in case, say, a hot war breaks out. Still, FBI agents didn't have strong independent proof beyond that CIA tip that the Czech doorman was truly a spy. Until one day in 1989, they did. After having reviewed countless hours of recordings, a rookie FBI agent watched some new tape in which the Czech came home from work, sat down in his Lazy Boy with a boombox on his lap. He unscrewed the back of the radio and extended some antennas. It was a shortwave radio receiver. He turned the box on. Digitally coded transmissions poured from its speakers. The FBI agent reviewing the footage shouted in elation. There was no doubt now, if there ever was, this was a deep cover intelligence officer working for the Soviet bloc. After the Berlin Wall fell in 1989, FBI spy hunters in San Francisco puzzled over how to approach the Czech operative. Should they arrest him? Seek to turn him as a U.S. intelligence source? In late 1989, three FBI agents working the case held a weekend-long summit on how they might best pitch the Czech operative to switch sides. Fortunately for the Bureau, the Czech had already been partially recruited by San Francisco itself. Amid this operative's explorations of the city in Northern California more broadly, the FBI learned, he had begun to gravitate toward Eastern-inspired spiritual practices. The Czech's commute took him through San Francisco's Haight-Ashbury district, and he became tight with a New Age crowd, attending talks, lectures, and spiritual meetups, and becoming a devotee of these Eastern-infused practices. As the Soviets' grip on Eastern Europe began to crumble, the Bureau determined it was time to strike. Officials wanted to use the case to help catalyze a final split between Prague and Moscow. Two FBI agents were dispatched to surprise the deep cover spy at home in San Francisco, and they took him to a safe house for questioning. Cognizant of the professional pride of intelligence officers, the FBI was careful to make clear that the spy hadn't inadvertently outed himself. There were other problems within the Czech spy service that led to his discovery, the FBI told him. That really pissed him off, recalled one former FBI agent. But the Czech's anger was directed at his communist spy bosses, not the FBI. He opened up about his background and spy training, holding little back. At the end of the evening, recalled the first former FBI agent, the agent told the Czech, "Well, we'll drop you at home now. You have to get ready for work tomorrow." He was speechless. It had to be some kind of trick. But it wasn't. The two Bureau agents drove the spy back to his house near the beach and dropped him off for the night, under intensive surveillance, of course. The agents told him they'd continue talking the next evening after work. The day stretched on and the debriefings continued. The spy poured out all he knew, and the information was valuable indeed, with the FBI harnessing it to undertake an offensive operation overseas, said the same former agent. Through these debriefings, the spiritually minded spy revealed himself as a very American sort of archetype, pragmatic dreamer. He had become sublimated in a particular kind of West Coast culture, sitting at the nexus of Silicon Valley entrepreneurialism and Bay Area hippiedom. He didn't run around in robes. He was very practical, recalled the same former FBI agent. He was business-oriented. He wanted to improve his life as best he possibly could. And that, he understood clearly, now meant working with U.S. intelligence. In the final days of 1989, Vaclav Havel, famous Czech playwright, dissident, and former political prisoner, was selected as the first president of post-communist Czechoslovakia. For his new intelligence chief, he chose Radovan Prochaska, who as a young man had joined an anti-Nazi resistance during World War II. He was later arrested in the 1950s for anti-communist activities and spent over a decade rotting in prison. In early 1990, Prochaska traveled to Washington for meetings with senior U.S. intelligence and White House officials. Eastern Bloc countries like Czechoslovakia said they wanted an entirely new sort of relationship with the U.S., but America's spy chiefs wanted evidence, shows of good faith. And that meant folks like Prochaska were going to have to bear all their secrets. To prove that Prague was no longer controlled by Moscow, Washington demanded a list of every undercover Czech intelligence officer and source in the U.S., including, of course, Prague's deep cover operatives. Prochaska and his team dutifully provided a list, but there were some glaring omissions. The deep cover operative in San Francisco, as well as other U.S.-based Czech illegals known to the CIA and FBI, weren't on the list. Why wasn't he being forthcoming? Were the Czechs hedging their bets in a bid to straddle the Soviet bloc and Western powers? We were deciding how best to handle it, recalled David Manners, the CIA's top officer in Prague at the end of the Cold War, but U.S. officials didn't have the opportunity to formulate a response. The Czech spy chief, still on that inaugural visit to America, did something that absolutely flabbergasted U.S. intelligence officials, both in its audacity and lack of basic espionage tradecraft. He personally telephoned all the Czech illegals within the U.S. he could reach, instructing them to leave the country as soon as possible. The Bureau was monitoring Prochaska's communications, and now it had smoking gun confirmation of all the Czech deep cover spies left in the U.S., the spies that Prochaska hadn't disclosed. Prochaska's shocking move forced U.S. intelligence to confront him. But it wasn't that Prochaska wanted to deceive the U.S. because he was pro-KGB, far from it, or that he wanted to keep some spies in reserve in case U.S.-Czech relations again turned hostile. His reasoning was more humane. He simply thought that these deep cover spies, who, like the operative in San Francisco, had done very little actual spying, deserved to come home. Prochaska's view was forged by the decade he spent as a prisoner of his country's security services. He knew how punitive such institutions could be. But for some of these deep cover spies, the idea of home itself had become complicated. During his discussions with U.S. intelligence officials, Prochaska came back and said, "What's Little League?" recalled Milt Bearden, who served as the chief of the CIA's Soviet East European Division from 1989 through 1991. And I said, "What?" And he said, "One of our people won't come back because he's coaching Little League." The ideal solution for Bearden and others was to interview these spies, drain as much information from them as necessary, and deport them. The Czech spies, however, had a different arrangement in mind. They had built lives here, some over decades, and they had families, jobs, American citizenship, the whole package. "Don't forget, a lot of them were here for a long time," said Bearden. "They had kids, and what do? Tell them, we're going to Prague. Dad, where's that?" Ultimately, more than a dozen of them were allowed to remain in the U.S. in their new, now true, lives. Presumably, they still reside in the States today, over 30 years later. The Czech deep cover spy in San Francisco, however, was not among them. When his long detailed questioning by the Bureau agents ended, he was deported to Prague. He would return over the years as a visitor. His FBI handlers made sure he was permitted to re-enter the U.S., but settled in Europe, putting his English to good use in a career in international business. During that initial expulsion, however, he traveled with an FBI escort to Europe, according to a former FBI agent who was briefed on the trip. Waiting for his flight in San Francisco, the Czech illegal and the FBI agent looked out together at a sort of sculpture garden near the airport, which included a big piece of bent-up metal. The Bureau man turned to the spy and pointed at the sculpture. "You know," he said, "you can make a lot of missiles out of that thing," recalled the former FBI agent. The Cold War was dissipating into the historical ether, and Vladimir Putin was years away from materializing as the czar of a newly truculent Russia. But some, it seemed, were already dreaming about beating plowshares right back into swords again. This was adapted from an article originally published in Politico. We've got time for just one of the Talking Points articles. We'll do baseball, how AI is changing the game. "The robots are here to save America's pastime," said Steve Buckley in The Atlantic. The Major League Baseball season kicked off last week with a welcome innovation, the Automated Ball Strike Challenge System, ABS, which allows pitchers, catchers, and hitters to tap their caps to challenge an umpire's calls on balls and strikes. The system uses the same technology as the AI-powered Hawkeye cameras in professional tennis, and every player was measured before the season to provide a personalized strike zone. A week into the season, it has been a big step to improve the manner in which games are officiated. Teams are given only two chances to challenge per game, though they can retain successful challenges, and the response rate is fast, so games aren't coming to a grinding halt for interminable reviews. That's as important as getting the call right, which the robot umps always do. "Perfection is overrated," said Jason Gay in the Wall Street Journal. "Sure, there's no virtue in bad calls, but umpires are among the most soulful, theatrical characters in sports. They're now howling about being second-guessed in public, despite still calling most pitches with their real human eyes. We're supposed to be cool about the robot umpires, but we're losing the value of human irregularity in this endless chase of machine refinement." "Imagine a World Series ending on a tap-off," said Jason Stark, also in the Athletic. "These are scenarios we have to think about now that baseball is living in the land of the robots. ABS is going to produce the most accurate ball strike calls in history, but weird and wild stuff is also coming." "This is obviously a temporary stopgap," said Michael Brendan Doherty in National Review, "one that involves humiliating the human umpires as artificial intelligence supplants their expertise. Soon, ABS won't seem unusual anymore, and everyone will conclude we need the robot umpires making every call. Because once you've conceded that the machine is the final authority," said Brian Walsh in Vox, "you've quietly eliminated the case for having humans there at all. ABS seems like an ideal compromise, with humans in charge and AI correcting their most glaring errors. But this is what happens when an institution knows that the machine is better at the job, but isn't ready to say so. Workers in many fields share similar dread as AI advances rapidly. It's not a question of whether machines will eventually replace humans. It's how much longer the halfway point can hold. For those umpires we love to hate, and for the rest of us." A couple of the shorter notes. Arctic sea ice has shrunk to its lowest recorded winter level. as temperature spikes shatter records around the globe. March heat records were broken across the U.S. and Mexico and Australia, across Asia and northern Africa, and in parts of northern Europe. Altogether, it's by far the most extreme heat event in world climatic history, said climatologist and weather historian Maximiliano Herrera. Women are 73% more likely than men to be severely injured in a car crash and 17% more likely to die. Yet auto companies test cars on male bodies, crash dummies only. While the National Transportation Safety Board approved a female dummy last year, there's no deadline for it to be adopted. The U.S. Army has lifted the maximum enlistment age from 35 to 42 and will allow those with one marijuana conviction to enlist. Only about 23% of Americans between 17 and 24 are eligible to serve. The rest are barred by obesity, criminal records, or poor performance on the military's entrance exam. On the poll watch, 32% of Americans have turned to artificial intelligence chatbots in the past year for information about their physical and mental health, including 40% of uninsured people and 41% of adults 18 to 29. Last up, a quote from Ronald Reagan, who says, "Peace is not the absence of conflict, but the ability to cope with conflict by peaceful means." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of The Week magazine. We hope you've enjoyed it. Please join us again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Week magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.